All right. Does anybody have any comments or questions or thoughts about any of this before we start in? Yes, Cyrus. Turiya? It's the third stage, Robert? Fourth. It's the fourth stage. It's the high, it's like there's dreaming, there's waking, there's super consciousness, and then Turiya is a very high state of super consciousness. And it's a very nice word. It just means as you progress, you go into these higher and higher states of awareness. There's a Swami at Lake Shrine who was called Turiyananda, the bliss of the state of consciousness beyond this world, the goal of all our lives. A nice place to be. Okay, any other questions? Right. It's a comma after it in the poem. It states of deep Turiya, comma, sleep. Sometimes people read it as Turiya sleep and then you can't figure out what in the world you're talking about. All right, we have this wonderful chapter about the sleepless saint that we're dealing with today. We have the same theme of Yogananda's always trying to run away from the life he's living. I don't know what the higher purpose of it is, but the practical purpose for us is that shows that everybody gets restless and makes mistakes. And also that he should be seized with such a powerful delusion as to have the desire to leave his master. It's a very good example to us that life is not simple. As I've often talked about, the theme of this book all the way through is that the masters are really there to set us an example of what spiritual life is really like. And it's very important for us to take it as a real example. So here Yogananda, after all a lifetime of striving, meets his guru by miraculous means, manages to come to his ashram, and then early on, and he sort of says, my one excuse is that I hadn't been with him very long, just gets this same sort of recurring delusion in his mind that really what he ought to do is something other than what he's doing. And I've noticed in all of us that we tend to have recurring delusions. You know, just sort of some persistent thought that if only a certain condition were fulfilled, then things would be better. And we'll come back to it again and again and again. It's often a good thing to begin to be aware in your life of what your particular recurring delusory patterns are, because then when they come back, you'll just recognize them as your old friend or your old enemy, instead of thinking that there's some new idea that's whose inspiration suddenly needs to be followed. And Yogananda sets us a wonderful, master sets us a wonderful example here in this running away from his own master to go again to the Himalayas. I don't know, you know, to what extent this is just a leela, a divine play, or what. To what level Yogananda himself was just rebelling against the task that was laid before him. Because not only did he have to give his life to uplifting deluded humanity, he was going to have to leave his India and go to this heathen country of the West and do the whole thing. And so it seems like Master wasn't going to give in until he'd given it a final try to see if he could get his Master's blessing on it. But I loved what Master says about Sri Yukteswar was silent on the point, and Master conveniently took that silence for approval. And again, you sort of feel Yogananda playing with us and playing with the states of mind that all of us are likely to have all the times through the years that I've known Swami Kriyananda. He often teases a lot, and he'll often tease about something that in other circumstances you might take seriously, so that you'll sort of practice making light of it, so when it rears its head as a serious delusion, you won't be quite so inclined. Swamiji often comments when people say, pray to God by saying, well, if you don't want me to do this, then you better show me, instead of asking, Lord, what do you want me to do? It's not the kind of prayer that's as inclined to get an answer, because then if God is silent, that's a very convenient response. It's sort of like, I'm going to do what I want and you can stop me if you want to. That's not, when you present that kind of challenge, even just in a human way, it's not necessarily so that you're going to prevent them from doing it. It's just more like, well, if you're set on it, then just go ahead. It's not the attitude of receptivity. So Master is describing for us that even with his own guru, he had to learn the right attitude of receptivity. And with these masters, of course, we don't have the experience on a day-to-day basis like Yogananda did here. But we imagine that everything is communicated in such explicit intellectual terms. And part of what we have to appreciate is that spiritual teaching doesn't come that way. It comes very intuitively and it comes very sensitively. And even now, it's not as if, like, you know, Lord, tell me if you don't want me to do this. It has to be much more holding ourselves in a state of receptivity. And even silence doesn't necessarily mean that God is for it. We have to constantly be listening and be very receptive in the deepest part of ourselves. And of course, Master was, but he also shows us that he had to acquire that by making his own mistakes. So you also have the picture of a very courageous devotee who's not afraid to go out and try it. And that also is a very important example. Even though he made a mistake, he was also not too proud to come back. And I mentioned earlier in this class series that this interlude was actually a whole year, which is very startling when you think about it. And I don't know at which phase of it he met Ram Gopal Muzumdar, and whether he went off to the Himalayas first or, and then came back and saw him, or whether it was really at the beginning. And, you know, what Master did, I never heard Swamiji say what Master did during all those years, all those months in the Himalayas. Certainly he was capable of... am I echoing in a strange way? It certainly sounds to me like I am. Okay, that... do I need to stand somewhere else? Pardon me? How about here? Is this better? Okay, do you mind? Okay, because it sounds weird to me too. Someday soon we're going to have all this shifted. I don't know if it'll just create a new set of problems, but at least we won't have the same old ones. When we get the light fixtures, we're going to get the machine that goes up to the ceiling again, and then we'll shift these ugly black speakers for smaller ones. So it'll all be fun. The light fixtures should come soon. Light fixtures don't even look so awful in here now that everything else looks nice, but the ones that we have are less medieval and more appropriate to the situation, you know, more elegant looking and less medieval. And then the black speakers go. Anyway, Yogananda on his way went to the shrine at Tarakeshwar. It's one of the few places. Whenever we would go to India for the first year, Swami Kriyananda would always ask if we went to Tarakeshwar. And so one year we finally did go. These shrines, you know, it's so... we're so inculcated in the West to equate holiness with materiality. And just we think of everything being just like super established. And it's always like... I remember when we went to Thailand on our first trip to India, we stopped in Bangkok. We were on Thai Airways and they had us... We actually spent 2 nights in Bangkok on the way to India. And we went sightseeing and we went to see the famous Golden Buddha. I mean, you know, an extraordinary gold-covered Buddha. It's really quite something. It's just off a little street in this little pavilion. You know, in Assisi you go and St. Francis's little tiny portiuncula, the little chapel that he rebuilt, sits inside a humongous, huge basilica that was built all around it. So you walk, you know, for a mile across the polished marble to the little tiny little hut which is in the middle, and then come out and you're just in this vast thing. I mean, that's sort of how we preserve things. So you think of a shrine as ancient as Tarakeshwar, and you just, that's all the images you have. And it's always shocking in India that it's always just about spirit, that they don't honor spirit by creating a huge physical thing around it. In fact, they understand that that's not the same thing. It's antithetical. So we went to Tarakeshwar, and it's a little sort of a pavilion, mostly outdoor, right on the river. The floor was totally wet and a mess because people would bathe in the river and you know, take a holy dip. They'd come up the stairs. They would be right in the area. I think the area in front of the shrine is really about as big as this. And they come right up the river, like, and up the stairs here, dripping wet, and everybody goes in the water in their clothes. I mean, that's sort of how you do it. People don't bother, don't change into bathing suits. It's a holy dip, so the women go in their saris and the men in their clothes, and you just come out wet. And then you come and walk across and go see the deity there. So the floor is just covered with water. I mean, it was just a mess. And as someone said, when everything is really messy in India, you always want to know what it's messy with. It took us a while to appreciate it was just river water. We actually also accidentally went on a holiday, which we didn't intend to do and we would never do again. And it was shoulder to shoulder. And I mean like shoulder to shoulder. I don't mean like you're standing close. I mean you're shoulder to shoulder. Just totally crowded in. And then all the devotees would come, and then there was a little gateway which they didn't let the non-Hindus go through. And the non-Hindus could go through, and then there was a room, you know, about a quarter the size of this, and you'd walk around, and right in the center was, and we could look in and see it. We just couldn't go all the way in because we would pollute it. There was just a big rock, just exactly what Yogananda talks about, a big black stone. And there was a whole miraculous story about where the stone had been found, and I can't remember all the details of it now, but everyone had recognized, and they treated that stone as if it were a living thing. They would feed it, they would bathe it, they would change its clothes, they would give it an afternoon rest. There was a whole industry of the pujaris there who dealt with this stone. And people would just go in and pranam to it. And we would sort of stand at the gate and look at them doing it. And then across from it was a bigger pavilion where people would go, as Yogananda describes, for healings, because it was a healing shrine. And in that pavilion, which was maybe three times the size of this stage, it was just open-sided with the top. There were just lots of people sitting and lying around, either because they were sick or because, like he describes, his aunt, you know, did a seven-day complete fast, just sort of went into that pavilion and was just there to pray for whatever you might need. So you sort of, there was this very, the word I want to use is you felt a lot of an aura around all the people who were in that pavilion because all of them were concentrated on something. You felt like you didn't want to intrude in the energy that was there. And here is this scene of people just all crowded up against each other and all wet. And it was a bit disconcerting to most of the Americans, and so when the opportunity came for most of them to go home, almost everybody did. But as it happened, their departure coincided exactly with the departure of almost all the rest of the pilgrims. And so the few of us, Rick, were you on that trip? So the few of us who were there stayed. And as soon as it's sort of like it calmed down a little bit, this extraordinary feeling of divine power just came over us. So it was just a remarkable moment, especially all the more so because there was just nothing, absolutely nothing, that the Western mind could grab a hold of to make you say that this is a powerful place. Even so, I mean, they're so tamasic in so many ways. This big, overweight priest comes to the edge of the inner sanctuary, and he has a whole basket full of all the offerings that the pilgrims have been making. You know, like by now it's kind of half-rotting fruit and dead flowers. He just dumps it out, right sort of at my feet, virtually on my feet, right in front of me, and then goes back into the shrine. And in a few minutes, a bunch of goats come just to eat it all right there. Like this is all at Tarakeshwar, this holiest of holy shrines, right? I mean, this to me is going a little far. Master himself talked about the cleanliness of the Westerners is something that Indians can learn from. But I'm sort of really telling you what it was really like because it made the contrast with the actual experience of it all the more profound. That there could be so much spiritual power in something that had no form that we're used to at all. And even the deity itself was just a rock. So you can see in the story of Yogananda, when he goes there and going to that place, which has been revered for, who knows, centuries at least, if not thousands of years. I don't know how old the shrine is. You know, everybody just understands. And also how Yogananda describes how the Indian consciousness is able to cognize that this spherical stone is a divine symbol. Whereas for the Westerners, it's just a rock. You just don't know how to get your mind around the fact that it's a divinely inspired stone. In southern India, where Sri Ramana Maharshi lived on in an ashram there that we also went to, not with the pilgrimage, but we went as a smaller group in the hope of being able to take the pilgrimage there, but the situation didn't work. His ashram is on a mountain called Arunachala, and the mountain itself is considered to be an incarnation of Shiva. And so all over you see these temples, and in the temples you see this little model of the mountain. And again, they just treat the mountain as if it were an incarnation. Now, I don't really know sort of exactly how to put all this into real perspective. All I can say is the feeling at Tarakeshwar was extraordinary. The feeling on that mountain was extraordinary. Ramana Maharshi is a great saint, and he lived there for many years, but he went there because it was holy. It wasn't he who made it holy, it was already holy. So you have this whole Indian perspective on spirituality that just takes our little American system and just sort of shakes it on its head like a salt shaker and just pours it out. Now, Yogananda didn't really come to teach Hinduism or to teach the deities or anything like that, but he includes in this book this very interesting story of how he himself went and thought, I'm not going to bother. Now, he wasn't discarding the stone because it was merely a stone. He was discarding it because God is impersonal. There is no symbol. This is sort of the, we're not able to tune in and appreciate as much, most of us, because we're not thinking about it. But there's a long-standing sort of debate among pundits and sages in the Indian tradition of whether God has form or whether God does not have form. Yogananda and Ramakrishna and others solved it quite simply by saying both. You know, he has form for a while, then the form breaks and he's free. So Yogananda is also speaking to that question and describing his own sort of, I'm renouncing everything, I've renounced even my guru. And so he goes to this place of traditional worship where undoubtedly people were doing pretty much exactly the same things that we saw them doing. I don't think India was quite so overcrowded then, but nonetheless it was probably pretty crowded. They were probably doing exactly the same things, just bathing in the river and prostrating themselves and then making offerings and going into the stone and so on, and probably in just the same mood because that's how it's always been done. And he just didn't want to have any part of it, you know, I'm apart from these things. But strangely, he just writes about it as a fact. His pride, he doesn't write about it as if the stone itself punished him, which is sort of a better way to think about it, but his lack of receptivity and his pride, just this little bit of holding himself superior to these devotional forms. I was thinking when reading this about the chapter of Master Mahashaya, and how Master said that Master Mahashaya was so humble that he just accepted everything and everyone and saw the divinity everywhere. And Yogananda, in the name of his renunciation, there was actually this, presumably this slight element of pride and ego in it, that he was now above this. And so as a result, he set in motion a dissonance. And that dissonance, sort of the, what do they call it in the Star Wars movie, a break in the force? You know, a disturbance in the force, right? He set in motion a dissonance, and he was just slightly out of tune. And so as a result, the peasants, you know, feeling that disturbance in the force, so to speak, created by Yogananda's vibration, gave him wrong instructions, and he had to go through this whole cycle. There's this, it's really, what he really received is what we sort of, in the vernacular, call instant karma.